My guest on Back to the Future this week is Merlin Hanbury Tennyson, the conservationist, Afghan war veteran, and founder of the Thousand Year Trust, one of Britain's first temperate rainforest charities. Okay, I know what you're thinking. Rainforests in Britain? Isn't that a bit of an oxymoron? Well, this is part of the incredible journey we're setting out on with Merlin today. A journey through Britain's ancient woodlands and temperate rainforests, as documented in his new book, Our Oaken Bones. But it is also a journey about healing, about well-being, and about how reconnecting with nature, from vertical farms and forest bathing to farm and forest wellness retreats, can regenerate the body, but, as we discover, also the soul. Merlin used his growing understanding of these ancient oak trees to come to terms with his PTSD, but also, and crucially, for the conversation today, to look at how the hidden networks that trees are woven into, this, I guess you'd call it, wood wide web, can teach us how to be better future ancestors. Merlin, thank you for joining us on Back to the Future.
Well, thank you so much, Martin, for having me on the podcast. It's a huge honor and a delight. And I hope that the future I see is not a fucture, is hopefully a positive future. But, you know, there are multiple outcomes. And yeah, while my focus is on British rainforests or the rainforests of the British Isles and Western Europe, I see them as a bellwether and a canary in the coal mine for all of our futures as humans and also the human story within them as well. So I'm really excited to chat to you today.
I did say, you know, trees in the generic sense, and I know that quite a lot of the book focuses on the depletion of the oak woodlands or oak forests in the UK, but really the bigger insight in the book was how you were asking us to reconnect with nature, and more importantly, how, I guess, nature can be re-engaged with us. You know, for example, there's a lot in your book about well-being and wellness. So this notion of regenerative, not just woodland, but the sense of how we as people need to regenerate physically and spiritually. And I really felt that the message you were trying to connect us with, that it wasn't just about ecology. There was a wider insight and a wider demand on our behalf to connect, I guess, spiritually and mentally with this change you were talking about in the book.
I couldn't agree more. I think we are a storytelling species. It is one of the many things that sets us apart. And we love stories, we love narratives, and we love human-centric narratives. And we'll all have heard this expression frequently, that we are a part of nature, not apart from it. It's becoming a trope. And I think that's a really good thing, that it's becoming a trope, because it's true. But as often as busy and distracted humans, I don't think we interrogate that expression enough. So we are a part of nature, not apart from it. I think there's been a big lag effect, a sort of a tail end of the monotheistic narrative that we are actually not a part of nature, that we're built in the vision of some sky god, and therefore we are in dominion over nature. And I rail against that. We are actually just as much a part of the natural world as an oak tree or a moss or a beaver or a water vole or a squirrel. We are within that system. And I think the next step for us, and this is what excites me about long-term future thinking, is what does that mean in a multi-generational way? If we are truly to reclaim our position as a part of the natural world rather than standing apart from it, as many of us have been indoctrinated to think we do, then what does that mean in a day-to-day way in how we live our lives, whilst also being a part of the natural world? And that, I think, is the existential challenge that I find it utterly fascinating to discuss and to tease into.
We talk quite a lot on the podcast about these existential threats that we are currently going through. And I think one of the constant themes, conversations comes up. We've talked about well-being, but beneath that, there's this whole issue of healing. You know, how we both approach the subject of healing, but also how we define healing.
Imagine if each of us just channeled 1% of our ability and our potential and our energy towards making positive change, healing change, not just for humanity, but also for the planet. Because I think, again, going back to that saying about being a part of nature, not being apart from it, is we often look at human healing and healing the natural world. We view them as two separate things. We say, okay, well, there's a mental health pandemic or there's an obesity pandemic in the West. we need to look at how we heal those. And then we'll look at it and go, oh, there's a climate change catastrophe and there's biodiversity loss. How do we heal those? We are far too binary as humans in our desire to separate out and silo these issues. And when we look at them as all part and parcel of one holistic challenge, then we can make greater strides. When we look at the UK, so there's this rewilding movement, which many people will be familiar with, and some will be very in favor of, and some might be rather against. And the rewilding movement has in the past fallen foul of sort of not integrating humans enough within rewilding and the restoration of the natural world. And that is something that the rewilding movement is absolutely correcting. But when we say this is for nature, it's not for humans, what we're going to do is we're going to fence this area off and keep humans out so that nature can be healthy. The nature is in a poorer state, but also the humans are in a poorer state because they're excluded, not just from a mental and physical health, but also from a rural community and a rural economy perspective. What we've tried to do here at Kabila, which is a lot of what my book is about, is say, is there a way we can walk a tightrope and heal both?
Just describe Kabila at the moment. What am I looking at? Is it a farm? Is it woodland?
So Kabila is a small upland hill farm on Bodmin Moor in Cornwall. My father bought it in 1960. It's about 240 acres. It was a mixed rotational grazing system. So he had some dairy cows, some beef cattle, some laying hens, some pigs, some Devon Longwool sheep. And they also did a rotation of crops of oats, wheat, barley, flat pole, cabbages, turnips, and set aside, which is a very standard way that these smaller farms would be run. Since my wife Lizzie and I took it over, we have removed the stock from the land. And we found that in the heart of this forest, we have this incredible slice of 70 acres of what I'd always grown up playing in and having my childhood in dens in. After leaving home, I joined the British Army and quite quickly was sent on three operational tours in Afghanistan. And in the first of these tours, I was in Helmand province and I was blown up by a Taliban roadside bomb. And it was about a decade later when I was living and working up in London that I had a mental health breakdown and started to suffer from complex PTSD. And it was this ancient woodland, this forest back home that really became a place of huge healing and succor for me. My wife Lizzie and I began to study and research what it was about these habitats that made them quite so special and incredible.
I find it fascinating that you grew up on the farm and all of these things were there and not necessarily observed in the way that you are now observing them. And then as you set forth into the world, because I'm thinking about, you mentioned about your time in the army and in Helmand, where obviously these things are hugely traumatic because things happen that suddenly jolt us into a different way of looking at the world. You return to the same place. It hasn't changed, but you have changed. And as a consequence of that change, you're seeing these things differently, a completely different interpretation. If you didn't have that moment in the army, do you think you would have seen this place in the beauty you're now seeing? Or perhaps the discovery would be delayed? I'm just fascinated to capture your sense of this jolt to your character changing the way you looked at the world.
I think mental health is something that I'm trying to work in the space of helping men to feel more comfortable speaking about their mental health. Suicide is the greatest killer of men under 50 globally. A man takes their life every minute. It's incredibly sad. And a lot of that is because we have ego, but also men, part of the male narrative is one around strength and being a protector and showing vulnerability and talking about when you feel weak can fly in the face of that. And I think many men really struggle with that. I want to make my life about helping men to talk and never go to the really dark places, which I found myself in at times. The immediate desire is to try and find a way to get yourself back to who you were before that happened, to try and go, okay, well, I used to be strong and resilient and not even think about mental health because I was young and naive and arrogant. And now suddenly I feel very vulnerable and weak and like broken glass. How do I get back to how I was before? The biggest thing I learned was that there is no going back. You shouldn't aspire to go backwards. You move forwards and you become a new version of yourself. Like if you break your leg, you might have to adapt to live with a limp. If you've had a mental health breakdown, you might have to adapt to live with a slightly different mental resilience. I'd like to think that I would have gone on the same journey of realizing quite how special this valley was, but I don't know if I would have. The vulnerability that this rainforest helped me heal from and develop and grow from was a big part of realizing how special it was and then wanting to share that with other people.
It really struck me as how much it was allowing you to self-reflect and to consider things about yourself in relation to the land that your father had originally farmed that you had taken over, the oak forest, that issue that it's 400 years, but turns out to be 1,000. So you have to make a mental stretch in terms of how we look at time and how we look at our position in it. But the other thing that really struck me is you say in the book, and this is something I kind of spent a lot of time thinking about, you said, I needed no one but the rainforest. This is when you'd return from Helmand, your friends were back with you. You said that Axel, who's one of your friends, goes to his family in Hull. Dobbo is off his family in Norfolk. And here you are back on the farm in the rainforest by yourself. But you really go on to say there's a clear difference between loneliness and aloneness. For one is internal, psychological, and painful. The other can be an important restorative balm when our bodies and brains have spent too long geared to respond to menace or coping with a deeply unnatural environment.
And mental health is always complex and very personal and individual to everybody. And I'm always very clear that, you know, yes, I did 3 tours in Afghanistan and was blown up. And certainly certain elements of my PTSD come from that. But I also spent time working for a management consultancy. And that's a far more traumatic experience in many ways. And also these organizations are often based upon high churn rates. They don't look after their staff. They run through them very quickly. You see the burnout for people working in that sector who are often not treated well by their organizations. And when you compare them side by side, in Afghanistan, you have the threat of the enemy, the fear as you drive or walk down any track that you might be blown up or shot at, there might be a sniper. And when those things do happen, that can be quite traumatic. You're also in a wonderfully embracing organization that has wonderful camaraderie and esprit de corps, where you're surrounded by not just friends, but brothers who you can turn to and rely upon for everything. You achieve true flow state with the people who stand next to you, because that's what it's really about, is the man or woman standing next to you, knowing that you can trust them and they can trust you. So you have actually really strong psychological resilience and psychological safety. And then you go into somewhere working in a city where you lose all of the psychological safety and security of your peers and the organization that you're within. And actually the trauma can be much worse in those settings.
I think that's where you're saying where the PTSD happened when you were working in the city, not in Helmand.
I don't think anyone has felt lonelier than when they live in some urban settings. This is often reported on, the pandemic of loneliness that people in, especially in hyper-urbanized societies, and I know it's a big issue in places like Japan and South Korea. Lizzie and I had it living in London in a block of flats, and we had people who for several years lived a couple of meters away from us on all four sides and above us and below us. And we didn't know these people. And you might get to know one or two of your neighbors, but you don't know the people who live so close to you. And then you go and live in the countryside where you get to know people very well who might live 5 miles away because community is stronger. And so I think urban environments and that urban work, like consultancy, but also many other kinds of work as well in urban settings, can be extremely lonely.
It is fascinating because I love living in cities. Coming from a farming community in Ireland, like a tiny fishing village, my first desire when I turned 15 was to escape and move first to Dublin, then to London. So I feel that not only is the city a core part of my being, but it also was a core part of my freedom. That said, as soon as I get to the seaside, you know, waves, shingle, marshland, fens, moors, I also feel a different kind of presence and a different sense of being present.
Oh, completely. And I did a lot of my sort of maturing and developing within an urban environment and still return to the city frequently. And it comes back to that point, which is we mustn't ever look backwards. I think that a really important part of creating a healthy and a happy future for humanity doesn't involve looking back to some prelapsarian idyll, some bucolic idea of a pre-industrial revolution world where everyone's happily walking around with scythes cutting the hay. I think we need to plan for a planet that has 8 billion, even more, 9 billion, 10 billion people on it, where everybody has effective access to the natural world. It opens up exciting conversations around how we plan for a future where we avoid a mental health pandemic because people are not getting access to the natural world, where we avoid locking people away with no access to nature because that won't help them achieve that state of homeostasis in their parasympathetic nervous state. There's a lovely expression that I read a town planner saying, which is we need to stop thinking about how we plant trees within cities and start thinking about how we build cities amongst trees. So how do we actually stop that binary approach that as humans we love of going, there are cities and there is the countryside, and say, actually, it should just be that there is a landscape that humans live amongst. Certain areas are more developed, certain areas are less developed, and everyone has access across them. So how do we break down these ideas, these fixations that we have around this person lives in a city, this person lives in the countryside, and say, actually, we all have access to stunning nature and we're all a part of helping to restore it as well.
I did an interview with Des Fitzgerald, a great thinker about cities. He was sarcastic about how we're greening cities, as if he said that is a solution in itself. We still have the demarcation between the country and the city, but we're just making the city a bit more palatable. Or we build business parks in the countryside and we make them a bit more businesslike. But he said it's not really addressing that interconnectivity. And he said one of the big issues isn't that we have such divisions, is that those of us who live in the city have a fear of the other who lives in the country and vice versa. We don't need more trees. We need more dialogue and more consensus. And then we can build these kind of connective communities that sit between city and country or between land and sea. What are your thoughts on that?
I had a drink on Monday evening with my great hero, Sir Tim Smith, who founded the Lost Gardens of Heligan and the Eden Project, some other amazing people who are working with him to integrate the natural history GCSE into our curriculum. Because the challenge that we have is that our young people, many of them grow up, and I speak to young people who say, I'm afraid of nature. I say, how can you say, it's like saying you're afraid of your own leg. We are part of nature. Nature is a part of us. How can you be afraid of nature? But they grow up not learning about the natural world. The number of people we have in this country who can't tell the difference between an oak tree and a beech tree, who don't know that a beech is native to the UK, who don't know what a native species is. I like to draw a comparison with countries like New Zealand, a similar island in a temperate zone where they have competitions for school children who are 8 years old in New Zealand to bring in as many non-native possums or rats dead as they can into school. And the one who brings in the most gets an award, a prize. If we did that in the UK with grey squirrels, the Daily Mail would be up in arms. But it would be a very ecologically sensible thing to do. We don't have an understanding of our natural world because we're not bringing it into the schoolroom. We're more focused on teaching people ancient Greek or calculus than we are on teaching them about butterfly species we have in Britain and what the decline in those looks like and how worrying that might be. And I think if we begin educating people from a young age to look up and see the wood for the trees and notice what is happening around them in the natural world, notice if it is native to these islands, if it's in a healthy state or a state of decline, then of course, if they know it, they will start to love it more. And if they love it more, they'll learn how to save it. And I think that is the most important next step.
It is interesting that we still have that division between what's perceived as cruel, because I always think if you come from a farming background, anybody who's ever lived, worked, or owned a farm knows that the essential nature of survival, not just the animals, but of the farms themselves, involves different levels of engaging with animals. Somebody who's a vegetarian, I grew up in a community where we had abattoirs, where we had fishing fleets. So you're aware all the time of things that have to be part of the food cycle that perhaps living in a city, we don't really want to recognize or talk about. And yet we will still eat meat. We'd still consume fish. When I was talking to Des about this, he said, we also need to know the stories of how people live, not just the practicalities, but the real human cost of allowing the city to work the way it does, of the countryside having to survive the way it does. As soon as we see the human story, and as soon as we see the great risk and pain and decision somebody has to take to do what they do, he said, we will better understand the way to plan the future together, and not as two separate species, as he described them, the town dweller and the country dweller.
And I think that education piece is vital. And that's actually the big thing that we're focusing on this year, which I think is hugely exciting. And I would encourage anybody listening to look up our charity, the Thousand Year Trust, because I've become obsessed with the idea that nearly everybody that you speak to, anyone who has had some form of formal education, whether they are 8 or 80 years old, will know about tropical rainforests and quite how important tropical rainforests are, that the Amazon is the lungs of the planet, and this is a very vital habitat. And the reason that we all know this is because there are probably 10,000 scientists right now in the heart of the tropical rainforest conducting multi-year, multidisciplinary research, pushing out peer-reviewed papers. And these papers will filter down in two distinct ways. One is that they will affect government policy, so that politicians will pass laws and secure funding to protect those rainforests. And the other place they filter down to is school curriculums, so that children are learning about how important these rainforests are, so that society cares about them. While so much research has been done into tropical rainforests, almost no research has been done into our Atlantic temperate rainforests. There is almost nothing happening that is getting temperate rainforests, British rainforests, onto government agendas or school curriculums. So what we're doing here at the Thousand Year Trust is we are building Europe's first Atlantic temperate rainforest research station, a place where academics, school groups, scientists, researchers, journalists, maybe even the occasional politician if they're well behaved, are able to actually come and stay in a 4,000-year-old slice of Atlantic temperate rainforest and study it and understand why it is our greatest carbon sequestering and climate mitigating habitat in the UK, why it is our greatest biodiversity restoring and nature replenishing habitat, but also why it's the most important resource we have for the mental health and well-being of the humans who spend time amongst it. Because when we connect the dots of those three issues, climate, biodiversity, and people, we start to find solutions that are truly holistic.
It is interesting how when I mentioned Atlantic rainforests to people, they had not really heard of them. On the other hand, they were very aware about the restorative or therapeutic properties of trees, forests, woodlands.
One of my life missions is to make sure that in the future, if I go into a classroom and ask school children to tell me about rainforests, some child will put their hand up and say, sorry, do you mean tropical rainforests or British rainforests? Now, we have cut down 50% of the world's tropical rainforest, which is a heinous crime that needs to be halted and restored. But we've cut down 99% of our temperate rainforest to the point that we don't even know it exists anymore. And I do think there's also a big need for us to see nature restoration on a local level. I constantly talk to people who say, why should we even bother restoring the natural world or fighting climate change when they're building a coal-fired power plant every week in China? Because that's the whole point. Bad things happening in parts of the world, and we all need to lend a shoulder to the wheel. There's 8 billion of us. We only need 1% of us to start meaningfully caring and doing good to make a big impact on a global level and especially on a local level. We would create resilience against storms because all of the weather would be dumped on the rainforest. We create resilience against drought because water is chucked up from these rainforests in that wonderful sort of mist in these cloud forest environments. And it would mean that the weather in the east of our islands was far gentler. So we can really make an impact. We just need to keep on being optimistic and believing.
Well, this is where I ask people. Normally, I would suggest that we climb into the fabled DeLorean because it is back to the future. And, you know, we can travel to the past and to the future to look at different aspects of how we would like to live. And I guess in this case, I'm going to change it slightly and suggest that we climb into an oak tree because you will know the Celtic cosmology for an oak being an interdimensional door that would allow us to access different dimensions. So I'm going to get you to climb up into the tree with me, watching the branches. I don't want to do any damage as we go up. Breathing in the terpenes, so we've got that great uplift that we're going to experience as we climb higher and higher. And then I want you to look back, because I know that you've set up the Thousand Year Trust, but I want you to look back what 1,000 years would mean in terms of the landscape, you know, the farmstead. What would people be seeing?
It's a beautiful exercise, and it's why I called our charity the Thousand Year Trust, because I want people to have that courage to look back 1,000 and look forward 1,000. Each one is only one lifetime of an oak tree. So it's not a huge period of time. It might be to us puny humans, but to an oak tree, it's one lifetime. And if you look backwards 1,000 years, we're on Bodmin Moor, and this is a 50,000-acre expanse, which at the moment has very few trees on it, very few communities that are thriving, very few opportunities for young people growing up here. And also, it's not doing anything good for either climate change or biodiversity. It's a prairie, which effectively is a bit of a green desert. There's peatland and little slices of temperate rainforest in the river valleys. But 1,000 years ago, that would have been much more of a rainforest landscape. We would have seen a mosaic, a patchwork of different habitats, everything from meadowland, grassland, peatland, rainforest, wood pasture. We'd have seen rougher types of livestock being grazed through it. So the cattle would have been closer to the aurochs. We'd have seen horses that were closer to the tarpan and pigs that were far closer to the wild boar, and communities and people living their lives across this landscape, having a meaningful life and existence. And also we would have seen more of the natural world that we've lost. White-tailed eagles, even things like the last few wolves would probably have lived on this landscape back then and would have been keeping the deer population far, far lower. Two species of deer opposed to the six that we have nationally at the moment, four of which are non-native. And we'd have seen those deer moving far more frequently because the wolves would have kept them on their toes.
Looking at the landscape now, because you described it as a green desert in the sense of, you know, while it's still beautiful and people will think about moors generally and Bodmin specifically and say it is quite a beautiful, austere, poetic place. But I guess what you're suggesting is it could be different, and perhaps for the sake of what we're planning to do in terms of restoring nature and restoring a different sense of balance and regeneration, that it should be different. So what would you like to see if we're looking to 1,000 years in the future? What kind of changes am I detecting on the landscape?
I have absolutely no doubt about what the landscape will look like in 1,000 years across the UK. I think we will have a much closer connection to nature as humans. We will live more in harmony with nature. We will still have benefits of the modern world, things like antibiotics and the ability to communicate and to travel over long distances. We will live in a closer connection to the natural world. We will have our trophic system restored from apex predators, wolves and lynx and birds of prey, eagle owls. Higher level of diversity in our invertebrates and our flying insect systems, much of which we've lost because of pesticides and neonicotinoids. There will be more rainforests. There will be more beavers on our rivers. There will be less flooding, less drought. And also there will be many people and communities living across these landscapes without damaging them, with restoring them. Where I see the choice that we have as humans is how we get from here to 1,000 years' time. There are 1,000 options, but I see two main ones. One route looks an awful lot like a Mad Max movie. The route that we're currently on, which is that different presidents and prime ministers launch bombs and launch wars, and we end up in some absolute dystopian hellscape. And that lasts for 100 years, 200 years before humans get their act together and realize that they will not be able to fight against Mother Nature. We need to live in harmony with it. In 1,000 years' time, we have that peaceful setting. The second option, which we're not on at the moment, but we can do it, it is harder now, but it is easier in the long run, is that we cease our ego and our arrogance and we start working in partnership with the natural world. The only God who truly exists is the one beneath our feet, this giant integrated organism flying through a vacuum of space at thousands of miles a second, which is alive. We have the honor to live on for brief periods of our life before the atoms and cells in our body return to being trees and moss and rivers and fish and beavers as we dissipate. We have the choice of running a multi-generational relay race where every generation passes the baton of natural health and restoration in a slightly healthier condition to the next generation. In 1,000 years' time, it looks exactly the same as it would have done under that Mad Max scenario. We're living in harmony with nature. There's more rainforest. There's more of the natural world, and people are healthier and happier. The choice we have is how we get there, whether it's brutal or whether it's integrated and harmonious.
How do you think technology, like if you think about AI, the whole notion of robotics, biogenetics, how does that fit into that 1,000-year time frame?
I think many people try and look at the current revolution that we're having around AI as a straight line graph, that we went from the agrarian revolution to the industrial revolution to the digital revolution and now to the AI revolution. And I don't think that flat line is fair. I think we're on a hockey stick at the moment where people use this. They say, oh, people were against the loom and then they were against the internal combustion engine and then they were against the microchip and now they're against AI. I don't think you can compare the same things. We are a part of nature, not apart from it. We are a wise ape that can build tools that we use to our advantage. I fear that I may separate from you in this opinion, but I do not think that AI is a tool that we are creating. I think it is a master that we are creating over us. AI is not a part of nature. I hope and I pray that it is a bubble that will burst. I have looked at it in as much detail as I can, and I'm yet to see a single positive outcome from the AI movement. It appears to be focused on two things, which are making functions faster or easier, which would have taken longer and been harder for humans to do. If a fundamental purpose of society and of capitalism is to create employment for the population that lives within that society, then AI only threatens that. I've tried to look at it from every angle. I saw early AI systems being integrated when I was in the military with some of our munitions, and I saw that as being hugely dangerous when you take human decision-making away. We're now seeing it on the battlefield in Ukraine, and it's disgusting and abhorrent. I then saw it in management consultancy where they started to bring it in. And I think PwC has dropped its graduate intake by something like 80% last year because of AI. So young people aren't being offered the entry-level jobs they need to develop their careers because of AI. That is not a good thing. Just because a partner at PwC can now create a spreadsheet using an AI program rather than using a junior associate, that is not a good thing. That is job theft to save costs. That is bad. And now I'm seeing it in the natural world where people are wanting to use AI systems for bioacoustic analysis or for studying climate models. This is work that can be done by humans and should be done by humans because we have morality, which machines will never have. And so as a result, I proudly put my hand up as a neo-Luddite. I do see benefits to technology and robotics, but not to artificial intelligence.
We did this whole thing looking at the Anthropocene age, where we're leaving industrial scars in the landscape, and we're now finding plastics in the sedimentary layers. So you got one level, which is where I think there's an indelible mark, which I think is negative. And then I look at what we call the Synthocene age, which was where technologies were enhancing human capabilities with a view of either extending our opportunity, extending our position, or helping us to outbid or outrun the inevitability of disaster. If we keep going where we're going and don't stop or don't consider, we'll end up perhaps being defeated by it, or maybe the technology. So I'm probably on the side where I believe that technology will help us outbid. I had a question which I thought was more interesting in the sense that if AI continues advancing, it will realize that perhaps the organism it should be chatting to isn't human, it's nature, and will simply remove the human virus from the equation, and nature will hook up with AI. Both will become symbiotic and live happily ever after, and we will just have gone through the sixth extinction, leaving the planet to get on with its own job.
It's amazing how these dystopian films, and I'm a huge sci-fi fan personally, and things like Black Mirror, when you first watch it, it looks like a terrifying fiction. And then suddenly we see these things being acted out in real time in our lives. I'm coming across this a lot as I write more about AI and talk to people more about AI, that people go, well, the genie's out of the bottle, so we have to live with it now. And I just think that's absolute bollocks. And we must stop saying that. I've read some really top journalists saying the genie's out of the bottle, we have to live with it. There are many things that we have begun to develop, like human cloning, for example. If we wanted, we could be cloning babies right now and making designer children that have certain hair color and certain eye color. And, you know, humans have dabbled with it a bit and then gone, I don't think this is a good thing for us to do, and have passed laws to prevent that from becoming widespread. Genies can be put back in bottles. And this is one that I think, rather like that, and like nuclear weapons, should be put firmly back in the bottle. And we should have the courage as humanity to say, the genie's not out of the bottle, and then we can pull it back in and put a padlock on that.
I mean, it's a big challenge because, you know, if I think about Future Laboratory as a business, we use AI to do a lot of problem solving that would have been a time issue rather than a thinking issue. So I always go, what is it that we're trying to achieve? To do research on X requires 10 days. But I always think, what am I trying to do? Is I'm trying to buy more thinking time versus more volume research time. It's almost where you work out what it could do and what position you take on it. When I look at what it could do, and this is where I always remind people that thinking is so difficult for us to do, finding time for it, time to be reflective. That's the bit that I guess with our teams here, we've tried to look at how can it allow us to be more reflective. I think you need to do that in tandem with how you examine the nature of the AI and also what you're trying to do with it. You know, otherwise you randomly apply a solution to a problem that you don't really know you have. We've not really thought about the consequences and we are rushing in. I'm hoping that's the next wave that suddenly people will go, let's hold on a moment. What is it we're trying to do? I fear we haven't done and we're not teaching people how to think. and teaching people how to be conscious or be considerate. I'm just aware of our time, but there were a couple of things that I really want to home in on before we go. And that is the whole issue of where you are now with both the trust and with the sense of how you've built well-being and wellness, and how these things aren't just about saving nature. They're actually about saving ourselves and making us more human. What are the next plans that you have, both in terms of the trust and in your personal ambitions and desire to move forward?
As I mentioned earlier, the research station that we're building, and there's videos and images of it on our website that we're building here on Bodmin Moor over the next year, that's our big focus and our big push. We've also just formed some brilliant partnerships around our landscape recovery scheme and looking to turn Bodmin Moor as a test case, a blueprint site, back into a rainforest landscape so that, that can be rolled out into other areas in Ireland or Wales or Scotland or other parts of the UK. So the big focus now is on the scientific research and on bringing young and aspirational scientists into or from all over the world. And there's nothing I enjoy more, especially we host some PhDs here from students from the global south, because we've spent so long kind of dictating from our ivory tower. Go, look, we killed all of our megafauna, cut down all our trees and killed all our apex predators. Don't you do it, to places in Central or East Africa. And actually, we have some amazing scientists here who are coming from places like Africa and Southeast Asia, who are able to teach us how to restore temperate rainforests and how to look at these habitats in a more integrated way from the experience they have from their own home countries. That's the real focus, is that scientific research and then getting this habitat on the agenda and on the map for our politicians to make sure that it's protected for all generations for the future, so that in 1,000 years, we do have that rosy vision and the pathway to get there isn't one of death, destruction, cannibalism and AI.
As a final thought, from reading your book, I think what was interesting is that emotional sense that you created with your journey and connecting people back to landscape, and also reminding people that that sense of landscape was also essential in terms of our sense of personal well-being. I think that's one of the things that has come through this, that if we get it right, there's a place for us all, and also collectively, we will feel happier as a consequence. Is there some final thought that you think you would like to leave people with that connect all of those different things together?
I think my final thought would be, view yourself as a participant within the natural world, not an observer. And certainly don't view it as alien to you. And if you can channel that just for 5 minutes every day, think of yourself over an oak tree's timeline and think of that 1,000-year timeline and your part within that, how you can participate within the restoration of the natural world, how we can reclaim our place as humans, as an ecosystem engineer, a keystone species, even as an apex predator, and how that can then make our human story on this planet one of positivity, with a brief blip that we've had over the last few hundred, maybe 1,000 years of negativity, but that that becomes our past, not our future.
Perfect. Just remind us again, our Oaken Bones is published by Witness Books, but it's about to come out in paperback. Is it the same publisher or do we have another publisher?
It is. Witness is an imprint of Penguin Random House, and it's released on the 19th of February in paperback, which will make it much more affordable for people. And it's also on Audible and Spotify and any way you like to listen to your podcast, read by me. I hope that anyone who does pick it up really enjoys it. And I'd love it if they contacted me and let me know if they enjoyed it, because I love having those conversations with people.
Fantastic. Well, I can't tell you how much you enjoyed it, how much it made me cry, but also I think how much it actually woke me up to better understanding the connections between nature, the future, and also this whole aspect of how, you know, at its core, it's this different sense of well-being it can bring to us. Merlin, many thanks for joining us. The book is called Our Oaken Bones, published by Witness Books, paperback coming out. So I'm going to leave Merlin in his beloved Cornwall, but hopefully we'll see him soon when I do my annual visit in Easter. It's Martin Raymond here. And as always, I'm urging you to keep looking, keep listening, keep learning, and of course, keep asking what's new and what's next. And with that, hopefully we can all make a better tomorrow happen.